This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. Dovnik is Professor of Materials and Society at UCL and the Director of the UCL Institute of Making. He recently appeared in the Times inaugural list of the 100 most influential scientists in the UK. He is currently scientist in residence on Dara O'Brien's Science Club and has presented several documentaries, including The Genius of Invention. And in 2010, he gave the Royal Institution Christmas lectures. Mark's first book is Stuff Matters, The Strange Stories of the Marvellous Materials That Shape Our Man-Made World. So, Mark, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you.
I think, first of all, we should talk about what we mean by materials. It's a vague term, isn't it?
Well, I mean, yeah, you can argue that they don't exist at all, which is a strange thing for me to be studying and all my life, basically stuff that, you know, is hard to pin down. And yet, everything is made of something. So there is this stuff. Obviously, the world is made of something, your desk, your trousers, you know, this microphone. And that stuff is what we loosely call materials. But once you start, and this is what I try and get to in the book, is that, you know, materials means many different things to many different people. Mm-hmm. There are whole different ways of looking at the world. Those who make the world, the craftspeople, the jewellers, the artists, the designers, the architects. And then there's the engineers and the scientists and the physicists. And then there's the cooks. You know, there is no end to it. People have different relationships with this stuff, which we call materials. And if you ask any of those people what they mean by materials, they will tell you something completely different. Mm-hmm. And so science, in a sense, categorize it. It's very good at categorizing, isn't it? It systemizes the world. And so there's a thing called material science, which I am a practitioner of. Mm-hmm. You know, I spend my life doing material science. So that's the systematic study of materials. But that isn't the whole story. And I really try and make that clear in the book, which is that we would like to say that we have the last word on this material world, but it's just not true. And that a cook who knows, you know, the meringue, knows a lot about foams that a material scientist may not know, mm-hmm. and vice versa, of course. And that's why when the two meet is often quite an exciting mixture. The same true of a jeweler or, you know, a designer or a, you know, engineer, architect. All of them have a different viewpoint, and those viewpoints not just about style, they're not just about whether you care more about how something looks or feels or tastes, or whether you think something is strong or weak or able to carry people in a jet engine. These are all valid things to ask about a material, but it's also about their means by which they interrogate it, mm-hmm. that they work with it, their hands, the machines they use, the microscopes, the language they use. And it's so rich. It's so rich, of course. It is everything. You know, uh-huh. There isn't anything that's not made of something.
And there's, although these materials that we're going to be talking about, they're elements, they're things that would exist regardless of whether we were here or not. This story of materials is the story of human civilization as well, and our relationship with them and how basically our lives are surrounded. And there's a field, psychophysics, which I just wanted to get the name in because I absolutely love it. It's a great term that studies our relationship with material. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, so you have, let's say you have a property called strength, and mm-hmm. people have got, you know, they notice early on that a twig is perhaps not strong, that mm-hmm. a piece of steel is very strong, and a ceramic, you know, interestingly, is very strong too, but has a different quality called brittleness. Those are all quantifiable things, and we do that, you know, absolutely brilliantly in the science world. If you then say to someone, how does something feel? Quantify how something feels. Mm-hmm. Now, that has both a physical component and a psychological one, because the physical component is how much it feels cold or hot. Now, that's to do with actually a physical property called thermal conductivity mm-hmm. and the thermal mass of the material, and you can measure those things. But it also has to do with your physiology of your body, of your experiences in life up to that point. And all of those come together in a thing called psychophysics. Mm-hmm. And the physics is the measurable stuff, and the psycho stuff is measurable too, but it is to do with, you know, you have to average over people, you have to work out some people are very different from others, and in the end you have to agree that what psychophysics says is that some things are culturally, you know, some material properties are culturally influenced and others not. So, for instance, crisps. Now, you put a crisp in your mouth, or potato chips to our American cousins, and there is a particular feeling in your mouth of mm-hmm. crispiness. Now, that's partly to do with that this material, you know, breaks up in your mouth, it makes a sound, you can quantify those things. But there's another thing, that your experience of crispy things in general in your life will how that material tastes. Mm-hmm. And that's amazing. And the manufacturers of crisps have studied the psychophysics, yeah. and they've worked out that the sound of the crisp in your mouth is really important to the taste, and actually the sound of the packet's really important. So if the packet is made of something that sounds very bright and crispy, you enjoy the crisps more. Mm-hmm. That's psychophysics, and that's just an amazing fact, and there's tons more of them.
Well, I guess a lot of scientists study one thing very, very, very intently. Let's talk about how you got into studying everything.
Well, it is one of those things, isn't it? I mean, in science, we're very good at kind of delving into things in minutiae. And as a kid, you know, I was standing on a station platform one day and I got mugged. And the result of that mugging was that I got stabbed. And I became, for a while, fixated on on knives and things like that and the material qualities of them and how you could have something that sharp that was so small, and that could really have that much power to slice through so many layers of my clothing and my skin of flesh. And I wanted to know, like, why can you do it with that? And why does sometimes paper do the same, but other times you think of paper as a very soft material? You know, you wipe your bottom with it. So hold on a minute, this is paper, you can get a paper cut, you use it as a tissue to blow your nose. These questions got to me at an early age, and I really wanted to know the answers, as you do. You know, you're a kid, why is that strong? Why is that weak? Why does that break? And then, of course, there's a revelatory moment where you realise that you're not the first one to ask these questions, that there's a whole subject. There's, in fact, thousands of years of people studying this. And then you delve deep into the books. You absorb it like a sponge. You go and do a degree, as I did in Oxford, to study this stuff. But it wasn't enough. I mean, actually, you realise that you're just scratching the surface of this wonderful subject, and I'm still doing it. And really, the world is just a very complex place, and we've created this urban world full of materials, and each one of them is, you know, has been a revolution in its time. Like, the ages of civilization are named after materials. There's the Stone Age, right? There's the Copper Age, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age. So this stuff is, I mean, very literally who we are. Take it all away. Take your clothes away and the buildings away, and take our knives and forks and spoons and plates. Take our houses away. You know, we're standing in a muddy field. We're naked, we're shivering, it's raining in this country, and we are not human anymore. I mean, not really, not in the way that you could really comprehend us.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's skip over some aspects of that story of human civilization's evolution and get straight to the Iron Age. Iron is the first of the materials that I want to look at. So let's talk about how we discovered it and what that changed.
So metals, I mean, this era of the metals, and iron and steel are, in a sense, the pinnacle of the discovery of metals in some ways, comes after the Stone Age. The Stone Age, you really can't have very much in the way of technology when you're in the Stone Age, because you've got this cutting tool, these flints. So you can cut animal skins, you can make rudimentary clothing and structures. But without metals, you know, architecture is a no-no, right? You can't, you know, chisel stone with a flint. You can't, it just breaks up. You can't, you know, unless you've got a saw. How do you saw down a tree? How do you actually do anything with wood, which is one of the most amazing materials around? So metals are the key to all of that stuff, and yet they aren't around the place. The only metals that our ancestors could find on the planet were stuff that naturally occurs in very small quantities. There's a little bit of gold around, there's a little bit of copper around, and actually there is a little bit of iron around, and this stuff comes mostly from outer space.
Mm-hmm, from meteors.
Yeah. So they hit here, and in fact, those bits of rock which, you know, they would have thought of having magical qualities, and when you find them in the archaeological record, often they are very revered objects, which they realised there was something very special about metals, which is that they're almost as hard as rock, so they can do the job of cutting, but they're infinitely malleable, so if it blunts a bit, you just sharpen it. If your cutting edge changes in some way, you heat it up and you bang it back into place again. Now, this is magic. This suddenly makes the difference between having a technology that works and really being in the Stone Age. And so the thing is, you've got these metals, but they're very rare. So what are you going to do? You're going to do nothing. You can't wait around for this stuff just to rain down from the sky. It's a few kilograms per year coming down from the sky. So it's very difficult to know when it happened, but at some point in our history, our ancestors must have realised that some rocks, when put into a fire, didn't become rock-like anymore. They transformed into the early metal. The discovery was copper. So malachite, or most likely, was being transformed into a copper. And so you turn a rock into liquid metal.
That presumably would have... That's an accident, right? I mean, obviously, this is something we can never know. It's one of those incredible discoveries. There was one person who first... I'm sure it happened in lots of places simultaneously, but one person, first of all, discovered this property of those rocks. rocks, and it seems more likely to imagine them setting a fire in a place where these rocks were rather than sitting there throwing various rocks into a fire. But I guess it could have happened
either
way.
It's very hard to know, isn't it? Yeah, and we tend to think of our ancestors as sort of people who are sort of more primitive and therefore less intelligent and maybe less systematic, but that's maybe unfair on them. I mean, they're certainly as intelligent as us. They had less intrinsic knowledge about the world, but they had far greater sort of maybe powers of observation. They were really in the world, you know. So someone who's lived their whole life by the fire, like without a fire their whole tribe or civilization dies, those people probably noticed a lot of things about fire. They probably knew them inside and out. And as you say, who knows? But that magical moment, can you imagine it? Can you really? It's very hard to comprehend, but the transformation, the power of transformation of a rock into metal, and then to look around you and realize all of this rock around them could be full of metal, and then to be trying it left, right and centre, and to accidentally stumble on things that work, but mostly things don't work. So turns out it's really complicated. So they got lucky with copper, and copper is quite a good metal, although it's quite soft. And so the copper age starts, and the pyramids are made with copper chisels. I mean, that tells you what you can do. Once you discover copper, you can make the pyramids. I mean, you have to have a lot of slave labour.
Yeah, because you have to throw a lot of slaves out.
Because it's so soft, they would go blunt. These chisels would go blunt about every three taps. So that's incredible. Imagine, I mean, you think the pyramids are amazing. Now think how amazing they are if you're having to resharpen your chisel every three taps. Then, of course, they realise that there are other metals around, and that if you put some of those other metals inside the copper, you've got alloys, and those were much harder to bronze. And the Bronze Age starts. That's a big revolution, huge step forward. But both copper and tin, which is the alloying element of bronze and a bit of arsenic, they are rare. And so there were huge trade routes, you know, from Afghanistan all the way to the Middle East, all the way to Cornwall, just to get tin so that you can make bronze. So not only is this material really important for technology, but it also sets up these trade routes, it sets up all this trade. And for some reason, we transitioned from the Bronze Age into the Iron Age, which is not so easy to understand for this reason. Iron is a much, much, much harder metal to smelt from ore. It's much higher temperatures, although there's much more of it around. So you're going to make the argument that maybe tin became so rare that people had to look around for other stuff. They found that they could transform these reddish rocks, and a lot of rocks that look red have got iron in them. Iron's very plentiful. I mean, there's really very few rocks. If you walk down a beach, pick up any rock, it's going to have some iron in it, but it's not going to have very much tin or copper in it. So you can get hold of rock with iron in it, but you have to have much higher temperatures. So basically you have to transition to a more sophisticated smelting operation. But once they had done that, then you could have iron all over the world. And so that perhaps was the reason. The other reason is that some people learned to make iron that was 100 times stronger. And that stuff is called steel. It was very difficult for them to understand why some iron was very brittle and weak and other iron was extremely strong. And some people could do it and other people couldn't. And the people who could do it would have been the most important people in that community, and they were revered. And the Roman army was built on iron. You know, the Roman army never went anywhere without its blacksmiths. I mean, all of its might and power came down, well, its military power came down to their ability to make this stuff, make it strong, reliable, hard. So there you have it. You know, it really, really became this thing that underpinned the whole of society, the whole of civilization.
The key difference there, then, between the various strengths of iron, the difference between iron and steel, as it turns out, and this is an element we're going to talk about later in the show, is down to its carbon content. Yep. So let's talk about how we found that out.
In order to make bronze, you have copper and you add a little bit of tin. So if you can make the two separately, which they could, and then you can do careful adding, and you can realise that, okay, so actually you don't need very much tin to make a really strong bronze. In the case of iron, the alloying element that makes it really strong is carbon, which is the stuff of the fire itself. Mm-hmm. Now that, for them, I can only imagine, must have been really confusing, and they didn't really cotton on to it, is that you put the stuff in the fire, and the carbon is seeping into the iron, so it's alloying the iron. Now, that would be great if more carbon meant harder, you know, stronger material, but it doesn't. You have to have a particular percentage of carbon to have optimum steel, and it's around 1%. If you put some iron in a fire for any length of time at the right temperature, you get 3, 4, 5, 6%. And the problem is that's not very good steel. It's a very high carbon steel, and it will be brittle. So they had to work this out. They had to get why was sometimes it working and other times it wasn't? Why did some iron seem to be brilliant? And of course, there are many extra complexities, but one is that other alloying elements which come in the ore, like sulfur, can really change it. So some ores, which are rocks with iron in it, are very good for making steel, and others are terrible, and you had to know which. So you've got these people who are walking around the world, and they can spot a rock that's right for iron. They can spot a rock which is right for steel. They can put it in a fire. They can get it up to the right temperature. They can make it at exactly the right carbon content without any science at all, without any of the tools we've got today. Those people were amazing. Those people were what we would call today geniuses. And they would have handed that secret down through the generations, and certain cultures could do it. So the Damascans could do it. The Egyptians couldn't. And Damascans sold their steel to the Egyptians. And then, of course, you know, the Japanese culture of making steel, and that was extremely advanced and it's extremely sophisticated and gave rise to the samurai sword. And you get this, of course, the sword represents this sophistication in the ability to make steel, because with a sword that can beat all other swords, right? Imagine going to battle with iron swords with too high a carbon content, so the first time you hit someone else's shield, it's shattered. Imagine that. You know, your whole army
is... You're not fighting many battles.
No. And you're against someone who's got steel that can slice through anything, slice through your neck, slice through your armour, everything. Now, those people are going to prosper, right? So the legend of the sword that can beat all swords is really a legend, in my view, about technical sophistication, being able to make this magical steel, which is really the hardest thing they can do. And, of course, these rights, Excalibur, you know, in the British Isles, is one such legend of the sword that could beat all swords. In my view, really about the steelmakers. If you've got that sophistication, and of course it gets lost, you know, the knowledge gets lost so easily. You only need one or two people who know how to do it to, you know, die unfortunately and not hand it down. You're not going to recover that knowledge by trial and error anytime soon.
Because, of course, they didn't know why. They had that knowledge. They'd figured it out, I guess, by trial and error, which were the right rocks. But the actual reason for it, they were not aware. The actual chemistry, of course, they were not aware of. So let's get to the point where we discover that. There's this guy, Henry Bessemer.
So chemistry comes about through the development of other materials like glass and other things. So chemistry comes about 18th, 19th century. They start to realise that you can start to analyse the composition of these metals. And, of course, you have to remember that although metallurgy and blacksmithing, let's say, is a much older than science itself, okay, there's different cultural contexts of it by the time science asserts itself, the Enlightenment comes along. So you've got the scientists who are interested in how the world works, and you've got the metallurgists and the blacksmiths who make the world work, right? And they didn't often talk that well together. So you had people who were starting to study metallurgy as if it was a science, and you've got people who are saying, I know how to do it. So there's a lot of kind of mystique and secrets and distrust. But sooner or later, they realise that there is this thing called carbon. That carbon exists in many forms, but it gets into iron and it makes it into steel. And that if you can control the carbon content, that is the way to make very good steel. And if you don't, if you have too much carbon, you get kind of brittle iron. They could make it by hand, but they couldn't mass produce it. And of course, there was this growing wealth, growing sense that if you could make steel on a big scale, you could start to really, you know, do fantastic engineering. The engineering we know today, the 20th century, in a sense, comes from this moment. The Industrial Revolution is waiting for mass-produced steel, but no one can make it. They have to only make steel by hand. And along comes Henry Bessemer. He stands up in an association meeting one day and says, I can make steel in a bucket the size of a house. And everyone is like stunned, and they don't believe him. And he says, I can do it. Look, I'll show you. And he sells licenses for his process. It's called the Bessemer process. And everyone goes off and builds their Bessemer process. And a few years later, they come back and they say, you're a charlatan. It doesn't work. It's absolute crap. You're just talking rubbish. And so he realises that he, A, doesn't quite understand his own process well enough. And maybe he got lucky. And what he's doing is he's melting iron in this enormous cauldron, literally the size of a house. And it's got too much carbon in it. So what he does, he bubbles air through it. Which, can you imagine that? So this is hugely, you know, white, red hot, molten, size of a house, you know, liquid steel, and he's bubbling air through it, which reacts actually with the carbon inside the liquid iron, and actually that reaction is exothermic, so it gives off heat, so this thing gets hotter and hotter and hotter. But the genius of it is, it reacts to form carbon dioxide, which bubbles out the top. So by bubbling air through it, he's getting rid of the carbon. And what he was trying to do was to make the carbon reduced down to 1%. Now getting a cauldron of liquid iron down to 1% of carbon is really hard, and it was clear that although he was managing it, not everyone else was. So he got together with a guy called Mouchet, and he said, look, what you really want to do is just get rid of all the carbon. Keep going right to the end so there's almost no carbon left. And then add 1% carbon back in, which you can easily
do. You can control that more easily than you can the removal.
And of course, I'm saying 1%, but you can add, you know, now we're getting into the finer niceties of steel. You want to be able to control even finer than that. But they were making cauldrons of the stuff. The Industrial Revolution and the huge infrastructure you see around you today is due really to that moment where people realised you could mass produce steel.
Just one further thing on steel then. So there's another revolution in steel that makes huge changes to the late 19th century and onwards in terms of civilization. You look at this for in the book for a great question, which is why we can no longer taste our cutlery when we eat. So why is that?
Yeah, so steel's this great revolution, but the one thing, the downside of steel, of course, is that it rusts. And so people end up building these enormous bridges, the fourth bridge, it could never be built with any other material, but it rusts, so they have to paint it, and famously it's so big they have to keep painting it continuously. And, maybe people just accepted the idea that steel would always rust, but actually there's a guy called Harry Brearley, and it's the 100th anniversary of his discovery this year, 2013. So in 1913, he starts doing some experiments to make stronger gun barrels. And he's alloying steel with various different elements to just try and see if he can make them harder. And when they don't work, he sort of just tosses them into the corner. And he's adding different elements, and he doesn't really get anywhere with the hardness thing. And he comes back a few weeks later, and he looks at this pile of samples, and they've all started to rust, except for one. And it's still bright. Now, what's great about this story is that he doesn't walk past that stone and think, oh, well, I don't know. He realises the significance of that moment. That means that whatever he added to that has resisted corrosion, which means it's a stainless steel. And he gets it out, looks at his notebook, and he realises he's added chromium.
So he also knows what he's added, which is the other great...
Yeah, exactly. Systematic experimentation. Take notes. Of course, this is a massive thing, because now you've got steel, this wonderful, strong, the best material for tools, the best material for bridges, the best, this is the archetypal material for tools and infrastructure, and he can make it without it rusting. I mean, it's really a miracle, because before this moment, and because it doesn't rust, that means that when you put it in your mouth, right, it's not reacting with your saliva in your mouth, and therefore you're not getting this very strong taste of iron which you get. Mm-hmm. So he makes a material that doesn't taste in your mouth. Now, that's very, very significant. I mean, forget all the other applications of stainless steel, which are many, but before this moment, if you ate soup, if you ate your salad with your fork, that fork was made of metal, but it wasn't, unless you were rich, silver or gold, mm-hmm. which are mostly inert. Silver, not so much. Gold, very. And so they're tasteless. That's why the rich had them, right? You were poorer, right? So you had a pewter or iron, or you had no fork at all, right? Or you had a spoon made of wood. But anyway, all of your cutlery, all of the things you ate, things tasted. Wood tastes quite strongly. Mm-hmm. Pewter, iron, copper, very strong. Bronze, very strong. So you've got this set of people who are eating soup and eating meat and all these sort of things. And apart from the rich, this is why there's that phrase, you're born with a silver spoon in your mouth, right? That means that you're rich enough to not have to taste your cutlery. And then he invents stainless steel. Overnight, not overnight, but within 20 years, the whole world isn't tasting their cutlery. And even today, go to your kitchen, open the drawer. There it is. It's so cheap now, you don't even count it before you go to bed at night to make sure it's all still there, People have, silver canteens of cutlery, which they only bring out at Christmas time because it's so valuable and rare, and it's meant to be a celebration of being successful in life, mm-hmm. right? But actually, silver tastes slightly stronger than stainless steel, and especially when there are acidic conditions like soup. And so really, those people with those canteens of silver, they should really use those every day, and they should bring out the stainless steel cutlery at Christmas, because that is a far better material.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and this week I'm talking to Mark Miodovnik about his book Stuff Matters, The Strange Stories of the Marvellous Materials That Shape Our Man-Made World. So, Mark, in this second part of the show, we'll look at a few of the materials that you talk about in the book, a few more materials, and I want to start off with one that I think I get the impression from the book that you're particularly fond of, and I am too. So, concrete. Let's spend some time talking about concrete. I'm a fan of a Breton raw concrete architecture, brutalism and stuff. Concrete. What is it?
It's essentially a kind of man-made rock, mm-hmm. which is very well suited to building cities. And I think that's that's what it comes down to. The Romans invented it.
Mm-hmm, this is a new discovery that the Romans invented concrete.
What's interesting is that they worked out that you could dig up this kind of stuff that was coming out of a volcano, had already come out of a volcano in Pozzana, and add some lime to it. And then, you know, so you can create this dry powder, which is ultimately transportable, right? So you can just put it into a sack and nothing happens to it. Then you add water to it and it turns into concrete, turns into rock.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very strong material. Now, if you then add aggregate, so stones and bits of rock to that, it makes it even stronger, even more durable, and able to withstand enormous forces. So the thing they realised was that instead of building stuff out of rock you had to cut from a mountain and transport long distances, why not pulverise all the the powder of this rock and create industries in a sense? And they had the infrastructure to do it. They had these road systems. And what they also realised is that one of the best ways to transport this around their empire was by boat. And that actually there wasn't always a convenient harbour nearby some of their major cities. And this is the amazing thing about their concrete. Their concrete set underwater. So they could make artificial harbours with it, and they did, and they're still still existing. So you can see that they almost bootstrapped the empire with this material. And the oldest concrete structure that we know of today still standing is 2,000 years old. It's the Pantheon in Rome.
And this is a concrete dome.
It's a concrete dome,
which is even more remarkable.
And people think, of concrete as being sort of a temporary material. It seems very transient in our world. So 2,000 years old. And the other thing is they think of it as often, you know, sort of utilitarian at best, and often people have a derogatory, they feel that it's not perhaps the material that they would like to associate with.
It's not classically beautiful.
Right, exactly. But the Pantheon, go and see the Pantheon, that is an amazing structure. And what the other thing I would say is, I mean, although the Romans, it disappeared, the funny thing about it, it sort of disappeared off the Romans went away, and I think you can realise why, because actually this is an industrial material. This isn't the material that you essentially make locally and do locally. You have to have infrastructure for this material to make sense, and you have to want to create infrastructure, and therefore it is that material, and that's why it sort of suits a modern world. So when the big empire of the Romans fell away and it was smaller kingdoms around, perhaps that's a reason, I'm speculating, that it fell into disuse and was only reinvented with a slightly different twist in terms of its composition, but essentially the same thing, you know, in the 19th century. And so what you have is a material that suddenly comes back into our lives in the Industrial Revolution when people are expanding, they're actually starting to create, you know, vehicles, you know, trains and boats and cars, and along comes concrete again and says, hello, you know, I can see that you guys are ready again for me, in a way. And so the incredible thing is today, you know, 50% of everything that's made is made of concrete.
Let's talk about how it actually works then, because as you said, you know, you concrete, you get this powder, you put water in it, and people will see, we're talking about concrete, but people might envisage like a cement mixer, a thing with stuff that you then use as a sort of glue. But concrete is not just a thing that you put water in and it dries. There's actually something happening there, isn't there?
Yeah, so what you're doing is a chemical reaction between the water and this cement. That has two incredible things. One is that anyone who's ever used some concrete, ever made concrete, realises that it comes out as a sort of liquid. And as I was saying, it's a wonderful thing about it is that you can pour a building into existence.
You see the foundations of a big building with them pouring it out the back of a lorry.
You create a mould, you pour it in, and then you get this building. I mean, that, for me, is a marvellously wonderful thing. So it sort of asks of you to just imagine something. You know, what you can imagine, we can build, the material says. And it is very much like that. And as you say, it's not drying out, it's reacting. Now, the first stage of the reaction, and anyone who's ever poured some sees this, is that it goes from being a liquid, which you poured into this mould, to suddenly changing into a jelly, into a gel. And you can see it on the top, it comes semi-solid, and it really is a gel. Exactly like the jelly you ate as a child. It is an interlocking set of what are called fibrils, which are these growing material, you know, calcium, a silicate material. They interlock and they trap the water in between them, and then that trapped water is able to move around a little bit, and you get this kind of jelly feeling about it. And then as more and more of the water reacts and as more of these fibrils form, these interlocking sets of almost like you can imagine the branches of pine trees moving closer to each other. That's how it's like inside the material until it's all used up. And of course that tells you immediately you have to get the ratios right. So it's not a question of just adding enough water so it's liquid, because actually you have exactly the right amount of water for the right amount of cement. Now, if you get that wrong, then there'll be water left over in the structure, and that will make it very weak. And in fact, there are thousands of buildings around the world which have got this water trapped in it, and usually no one sees it for 10 or 15 years until something dramatic happens, like an earthquake. And you see it, you know, you see it in Haiti, you see it in lots of places around the world where you have very poor concrete, an earthquake comes along, and three quarters of the infrastructure of the city disappears. And this is, you know, of course, terrible. I mean, it's disastrous. So it's not a material. It may seem like a simple material. It's not a material. It's got an extremely, you know, complex structure. It is a chemical reaction. You have to really understand it. And yet it allows us to do so much.
There's one technological difference with the modern concrete in comparison to what the Romans did, and it involves the material that we talked about in the first half, steel. So let's talk about modern concrete and steel.
Yeah, so concrete the Romans built, it had a big problem with it. I mean, it was great for lots of things, but it couldn't take any kind of bending forces. So although you'd have thought that most buildings and ports and all these things in which they built would have bending forces in it, they built them in such a way that all the forces are compressive. So everything is compressing the material together.
Mm-hmm.
And under that, those kind of forces, it is fantastic. If you now think of a piece of wood and imagine pushing the two ends together, imagine that wood is now made of concrete. It would have been, the Roman concrete would be very, very, very resistant to that force.
Mm-hmm.
But now try taking the two ends of your stick of concrete and then just flexing them. That's a bending force. And it creates a tensile force in the top. Now that, it'll snap immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And so here is a material that you can't really do that to. And that really hampers what you can do with it. And you can't, for instance, make a flat roof or a flat floor, because mm-hmm. as you stand on that floor or that roof, you are going to bend it.
Yeah.
You can see that in your head. You can imagine that moment, and of course the whole thing's going to fall through. So how to get around this problem? Turns out that you can put steel inside the material, like an internal skeleton. And steel is very good at bending. And so you sort of combine two materials together. You've got the steel, which because it was industrialised, was now cheap, or cheaper, and you could put it inside the concrete, which was able to be poured into existence and had these enormous compressive strength. And you had the best of both worlds. Anyone thinking that experiment up must have thought, well, that'll never work, because as soon as the temperature goes up or down, you know, you go down to minus 30 in some places and you go up to 40 or 50 degrees in other places, surely the two will expand and contract at different rates, and that will end up just pulling the structure mm-hmm. apart. And here's the thing. Turns out by luck, or just because we happen to live in this particular universe, that steel and concrete expand and contract roughly the same. And so there it is. They are well-matched partners. And without that, this world would be very different.
Mm-hmm.
Because without that, we wouldn't be able to build our airports and our roads and our, you know, sewer systems and our wonderful buildings out of concrete. And because of that, we would have very different architecture.
We'd have
a very different
skyscrapers, city. For instance.
Yeah. Well, you can build them purely out of steel, but it's...
To a certain height.
Yeah. To the foundations would be different. And, yeah, the world would be a very different place. These massive infrastructure projects, like the Channel Tunnel,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, these enormous airports mm-hmm. that we build, you know, with these huge runways, what are they made of? Concrete. You know, it really is the material of choice. So you don't think of aviation as being anything to do with concrete, but actually you have to land, and you land on concrete. And so it is ideally suited for an advanced civilization like ours.
There are issues with concrete. It doesn't necessarily, you know, the weather has an effect on it, especially in climates like our own. You know, it quickly discolours and things like that. But you talk in the book about a fantastic, revolutionary new type of concrete, a self-cleaning concrete. How does this work?
Yeah, so... Yeah, as you say, I mean, concrete, like all material, mm-hmm. will discolour. I mean, you make a wooden building, you'll find it's discolouring.
Sure.
you make a brick building, you know, all materials do. I mean, concrete discolours in a way that we find objectionable, and it's, you know, people, you know, it's an aesthetic issue. And I'm not saying it's a trivial one, but there it is. But, yeah, so there's a new type of concrete called self-cleaning concrete, which will clean itself. It works because a material called titanium oxide has been put into the concrete. Now, titanium oxide is a photocatalyst material. And what that means is that when light hits it, it creates what are called little free radicals. These are little chemical molecules that run around and they're looking to react with something. They're very reactive
mm-hmm.
for a very short period of time, and they've been basically brought into existence by a bit of light hitting this crystal. And if those reactive molecules hit a bit of dirt or hit something that, you know, is reactive, like some bird poo or something like that, they will react with it, and that reaction will make that poo fall apart or that soot foot apart, and so this material constantly flakes off when it's exposed to sun, all this stuff that ends up on it. And so organic matter in particular comes off very easily, and so, you know, I mean, it's not about a day, we're talking about a few months of sunshine and the rain and the wind then washing that stuff away.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a church in Italy built for this self-cleaning concrete so that it remains white forever.
And are we starting to see this more and more then? It's obviously more expensive than the normal concrete to use this process.
Yeah, so it's more expensive and...
But then everything's more expensive than concrete, right?
Yeah, concrete is the cheapest building material by a long, 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 long way. And I suppose that's the pity of it, really, which is that when you look at the world and maybe you kind of do or don't like some material or some architecture or something about it, who is creating that object, that thing? And often it's not a person.
Mm-hmm.
It's an organisation, a massive company that may own huge swathes of a city. And what they want, often, is the maximum return they're going to get for that. And they want to pay the least they can get for the maximum office space or the maximum car parking space. And so, and I know there are planning laws and all these sorts of things, but actually those people are less powerful than the corporations. And I think, for me, you know, the material gets a bad name, concrete. You know, even though there are some fantastic architecture, clearly the Pantheon's one, Sydney Opera House, I mean, there are many, many, many wonderful concrete, you know, the Millau Bridge. You know, so what you've got is a material taking the stick, right? For, I think, very, very poorly thought through construction sometimes.
I want to move on to look at another material. And again, it's one that we can credit with the Romans for inventing.
Yeah, the Romans are great, aren't they?
They pretty much invented
what do they ever do for us?
Everything, yeah. Apart from aerogel. They didn't come up with aerogel, but, you know. But glass I'm talking about. So another thing that eventually would, you know, revolutionise huge areas of our life, again, the Romans discovered.
Well, it came before the Romans glass itself. I mean, the discovery that you could turn, let's say, sand, which is pure silica, into glass came much earlier than that. And it's an old material. But the actual use of glass into an everyday object, into a functional object, is what the Romans really perfected. And once again, they kind of industrialised the process and made it very democratic. And that's, you know, that's also true of a lot of these materials. You know, what's happened to them is that they've allowed everyone to live a more luxurious and, you know, wonderful life. And in the case of glass, before the glass, as in the drinking glass, comes along with the Romans, you have everyone's drinking out of opaque vessels.
Mm-hmm.
So no one can see what they're drinking. And then, so you've got, you know, let's say pewter or wood or ceramic goblets. And then the Romans come along with the glass, transparent, so you can see the colour of your wine or your juice. And this is a wonderful thing. This is new. Everyone loves it. And this changes, this means that wine starts to be made in order to not just taste good, but to look good. And you do drink with your eyes, you eat with your eyes. This is a recurring theme throughout history, but as soon as that comes along, as soon as they master that, which is a sort of glass-blowing technique which they invented, they also invent the window itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, can you imagine buildings that windows? They're called windows because the wind that went through them. Okay, and so suddenly, you know, you've got the ability to live in a light place instead of darkness, really. Mm-hmm. You know, people lived in dark, dark places, or they lived in very windy, rainy places. And to have both, which we almost all enjoy now, is due to this material and due thanks to the Romans for really getting into it and understanding how to make it on a large scale and understanding how to make flat planes of it, how to make the drinking glass out of it. Yeah, I mean, glass revolutionised our world in so many ways.
But one of the ways in which it revolutionised our world is basically it's an integral part of the scientific revolution as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting story because in the East, glass doesn't really get developed. It's used to coat the outside of their ceramic ware, but they don't really ever exploit it as a material in itself.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the West, it, as I say, the Romans get into it. So you can contrast the Western windows and then the development of the cathedral and the stained glass window, which is sort of like, you know, palace to light, and the idea that you can manipulate light through glass. And then if you can contrast that with the temples of the East, which are built of stone and the windows of paper. And this continues. I mean, this continues for 1,000 years. And in the West, this may be, you may think, well, it's an aesthetic issue. You know, who cares whether I live in a building with or without a glass pane and I can cope with the wind and the rain. But as soon as you start manipulating glass and being able to do that, you also notice that you can make a lens. And once you can make a lens, you can manipulate light in a different way. You know, you can make a magnifier, and that means you can either make a telescope or a microscope. And the telescope changes our worldview because it means that for the first time you had experimental evidence that the Earth goes around the Sun, and that other planets have moons, and so there isn't the Earth at the centre of the solar system. And it's revolutionary. I mean, this is the instrument that gets Galileo into so much trouble, and the telescope never gets invented in the East. And similarly the microscope. And you have to wonder whether the explosion of science and technology in the West, which was lagged far behind the Chinese until this moment, you have to wonder whether it's just down to the fact that we, in a sense, liked glass more than they did.
Well, even on a more prosaic level, and I guess I'm thinking of now, but, you know, you go into a lab and it's full of glass. You just couldn't do the work in a scientific lab if it wasn't for glass beakers and jars and...
Exactly. Chemistry as a subject, almost, you can't imagine it existing.
No.
I mean, because without glass, you can't do essentially the very fine scale work that you need to understand the world.
To just observe what's
yes,
going
exactly.
on.
Yes, yeah. exactly. And so this it sort of invents the subject of chemistry, or it's integral to the subject of chemistry. It's integral to the subject of physics, of course, in terms of the microscope and the telescope, astronomy, and about understanding the internal world of matter itself, material science. And it's through, of course, the glass lens that we finally start to crack the idea about what's going on inside steel and the carbon and what role carbon is playing in there. And so... Yes, I mean, it has so many tricks up its sleeve, and it also is very likely responsible for the invention of lager.
Which is always a good thing.
Yeah, because of this fact that actually, once glass gets mass-produced in Europe, people stop drinking, well, they don't stop, but, you know, people are drinking beer, not out of pewter or ceramic mugs, but out of glass mugs, and they suddenly realise what they're drinking. And like the Romans before them, they think, oh my God, this is a bit opaque and... dirty looking muddy beer. I'd rather have a clear beer. And so not long later, lager is born, a clear beer brewed arguably only for what it looks like and not really for its taste. It's very light tasting in any case.
Well, you mentioned that in the East, in, you know, the empires of China didn't necessarily utilize glass and therefore was somehow left behind in the scientific revolution. What they did have is porcelain, which you talk about in the book as well, which is a whole other story, but I'm going to skip over that now because I just want to finish this part talking about a completely prosaic material that I mentioned earlier, aerogel, which is... I've actually seen some. I went to the JPL in Pasadena last year and saw a piece of aerogel and have subsequently also been fascinated by it ever since. Tell us.
Well, it is one of those materials that once you see it...
Yeah, absolutely.
You cannot forget it. It is really like no
other. Because it's spooky.
It is spooky. It looks like... I mean, if someone said to you, here's this material, we found it in an alien crash.
Yes.
You'd believe them.
Yes.
Because it just doesn't look like it's of this earth. And people call it looks like frozen smoke. But it doesn't look like anything because it just looks like itself and you've never seen it before and you'll never forget it. It's a very interesting material. So the stuff that NASA make is called silica aerogel and it's made of sand. I mean, it's a glass, actually. It's a glass foam where the holes in the foam are nanoscale. So it's a solid material, but it's full of holes. Those holes are so fine you can't see them. And there are so many of them that it's 99.8% air. So this stuff... is only 0.2% not air. And that's the weird thing about it, is that it's translucent. When you look at the edge of it, you can't really see where it stops and the air begins, and there isn't much difference between them. It's also got this bluish haze, and that blue is not a dye, and it's pure silica. And it's because the holes, these tiny holes, which it's mostly full of, are nanoscale, and so they scatter light in the same way that light is scattered in the sky.
So aerogel is blue because for the same reason that the sky is blue.
Yeah. So when you hold a piece of aerogel in your hand, you're holding something almost as light as sky that's blue for the same reason the sky. It's as close as you'll ever get to holding a piece of sky, and it is wonderful.
As wonderful as it is, it's not that useful.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's hard. The history of materials is, of course, a history that most materials get invented, played around with, and then don't make it into our lives. It's true. And this may be one of them. But it is one of the best best insulator on the planet. So this is much, much better than any other thermal insulator around. And people are very keen on making it, not so much for its aesthetic beauty, but actually just making it into a form that you can insulate your clothes or your shoes or, in fact, your buildings. Because, of course, global warming means that the cheapest way to deal with decreasing our energy demands on the planet is to be more efficient the way you use it. And that's mostly insulation can take us a long way, 20-30%. So if we had a really good insulator, which aerogel is it, you can imagine that it could have a big part to play in our lives. And they did make some clothing out of, you know, which was insulated with aerogel. They took it to the Arctic and it was too warm. They found it was too hot. So this stuff is good.
So what's the feasibility of its use for? Because when we generally talk about aerogel, it's talked about in terms of its lightness, and therefore NASA make it for the space program because it means they can insulate things that it's not heavy, because that's a key aspect of what you want to put into space. In terms of making enough of it to insulate a house, which is a brilliant idea, is that actually practical at the moment?
You know, mass production always makes things cheap. It's really the price of it, because it is just sand, really. The price of it is essentially to do with demand.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, of course, is it's functioning not up to the job yet for one reason, which is it's brittle.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically falls apart into powder when it gets kind of stressed too much. And because it is quite strong, but it's strong per weight. I mean, mm-hmm. it doesn't weigh hardly anything, so you don't have to put very much force on it to break it. So the question is how to make it a bit tougher. And that people are working on that now, and I wouldn't bet against them, to be honest. And the beauty of it is that if they succeed, you have got this very light insulator that's best in the world. And I think we do really need to stop leaking heat and energy out of all of our technologies, because it's just bonkers.
This is Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and this week I'm talking to Mark Miodovnik about his book Stuff Matters. So Mark, for the third part of the show, I want to devote this whole part to ostensibly just one material, although as it will turn out, there are lots of different forms of this material. This is carbon. So I'm often described as a carbon-based life form, and a diamond is a carbon-based, not a life form, a thing. There's a lot of differences between me and a diamond. So carbon, let's talk about, you know, why does it come in so many different forms?
Well, I mean, yes, you've talked about carbon being diamond, which is the hardest, well, one of the hardest materials around.
And not anymore, as we'll perhaps talk about.
And then you've got, of course, coal.
Mm-hmm.
And graphite, which is graphite in your pencil, is exactly the same chemically as the diamond in your ring. Mm-hmm. Exactly the same. And that is, you've got a form of carbon in graphite, which is a lubricant. I mean, mm-hmm. actually, you can spread it onto a piece of paper, and you're basically spreading this very, very soft material onto paper. It's used in many machines as an actual lubricant itself. And so how can that be? You know, that is really weird. And then, as you alluded to, there are actually now many more forms of carbon which we've discovered. So that's pure carbon.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, we're thought of as a carbon life form. We know we're a type, and life in general is reliant on mm-hmm. the properties of carbon with other molecules to create these carbon molecules. So, yeah, so why carbon? And it's a really deep question of which I don't have a good answer. And I think that's fine, because mm-hmm. there's just a lot to discover about this material. But the difference between, let's say, graphite and diamond to start with is purely that the way the atoms are connected to each other at the atomic scale mm-hmm. into different crystals. So they're both crystals, but one is what's called a cubic form of crystals in the case of diamond. That gives the atoms a very, very stable structure, a mechanically stable structure, so mechanically stable it's very hard to move them around, and that's what makes it hard. In the case of graphite, they're in these little hexagonal patterns, like a sheet of hexagonal patterns of carbon, and each one of those is actually pretty strong, actually, but they're each sheet of them is laid on top of each other to make the whole material. Those can slip over each other really easily. And it's that sliding of one sheet of these hexagonal mm-hmm. arranged carbon atoms over the other that makes graphite such a soft material. So people kind of bemused about this and think, oh, that's incredible. So you just change one form of crystal into another, and you go from the hardest material to almost the soft material. It's incredible. What else can we do with it? And for a long time, people, you know, didn't do anything. And in fact, the fact that they were the same material itself historically wasn't known to, you know, wasn't known. People didn't realise that carbon in the form of graphite. And of course, if you just add a little of some impurities, you get coal. I mean, they're not so different from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, soot from a candle is the same sort of stuff. Soot in a candle is a form of carbon which has no structure, really. It's sort of just sort of amorphous in a way. But recently people found that actually in that soot of the candle is mostly this amorphous form of carbon which forms this black mark on anything you put over it. But in it is this other form of carbon. And that form is called a buckyball.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the shape of a football. And so it turns out the carbon itself can form many different arrangements at the atomic level. And in fact, not just a ball, but a tube, and these are called nanotubes. And these things have incredibly remarkable mechanical properties and electrical properties and chemical properties. And so it's a hint as to why carbon forms so many molecules, because a lot of the other elements of the periodic table, you know, so everything's made of an atom,
mm-hmm.
and there aren't that many, there are about 100 different types of atom. But carbon is prolific in the number of things it reacts with.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a hint with it when you look at its different forms, as I was saying, these buckyballs, these nanotubes, and this diamond. You get a hint that it can do, it's like a sort of, it's like the Lego mm-hmm. of the, you know, the molecular world. But then you start looking at our bodies and describing where carbon, what it's forming in that, and you have these things called proteins and carbohydrates, you have everyone's, and they're all based on the fact that carbon can interchange its different bonds and shapes and react with different things and infinitely reuse itself, change its shape, change its form, and in doing so become a different property. So that's that, in a sense, then gives you a hint as to why, with the same ingredients, your body can manipulate carbon molecules to produce skin, bone, hair. It gets all the same stuff it starts with, and yet out comes us and a bird mm-hmm. and a fly and a tree. So you asked, you know, what's so special about carbon? And it's to do with the fact that it can form all these bonds and it can change its morphology so much and be so flexible.
We'll look at some of the newer discovered forms of carbon in a while, but let's go back to diamonds. Diamonds, again, are another thing that here on Earth are incredibly rare, so therefore they're considered valuable. And, you know, the biggest diamond ever found is, what, about the size of a fist or something on Earth?
Well, bigger than that. Yeah.
Bigger than that?
Yeah. Okay, head, but your head.
Okay, oh, that big. Okay, I didn't think it was quite that big. But you actually talk in the book about out there might be, you know, out in space, there might be diamonds that are somewhat bigger than this.
Yeah, well, so on Earth, carbon is quite a rare element. Mm-hmm. I know that...
We think everything is made of carbon.
We're quite plentiful, you know, there's 7 or 8 billion of us, right? But actually, carbon is technically a sort of trace element on mm-hmm. the Earth. And out there in space, in different parts of the universe, it's not such a trace element. It's been concentrated in the same way that the Earth is a big lump of iron and oxygen and silicon. But out there in space, there are different parts of the universe where carbon is a whole, you know, there's a whole planet which is almost pure carbon. And that's an amazing thing to think. And that planet has had such a large gravitational field on it that instead of it, you know, it's been pressed essentially into the form of perhaps diamond, we're not sure now. And so, you know, that's a planet which is a whole diamond. I mean, that really is extraordinary to think of it, but as far as we know, that is entirely plausible.
Let's have a look at some of the, you know, you mentioned previously, possibly accidentally, graphene rather than graphite, which is this revolutionary new material discovered by André Geim up in, is he in Manchester?
And his co-worker, yeah.
And tell us the story of their discovery of this thing, because it's a really great, it's another great example of rather prosaic science.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's both. I mean, I think it tells you a lot about the current world, which is that I was saying to you that the reason that you can put a mark on a piece of paper with a pencil is that you're actually spreading these atomic layers of carbon onto the paper, and they slide over each other really easily. And so there you are, you have your pencil mark. Now, each one of those layers of carbon, which is these beautifully arranged atoms of carbon in a hexagonal array, you know, that what is the material properties of that one layer? Like, we know that if you put them like a pack of cards, they all slide each other over each other. But what if you just take one of them? What is it like? And so people were very keen to get hold of one, just one, because it was only one atom thick, and just work out what it would be like. Maybe it's, you know, maybe it's not very strong. And they did the calculations, and they thought, if you do the quantum mechanic calculations, what you need to do to understand the strength, it should be the strongest material around.
Mm-hmm. We would think that this, to get this one layer, we need to get one layer of this stuff. This sounds like a thing that's going to take, you know, a huge, expensive machine, lots of researchers to do.
Yeah.
How do we...
So, yeah, exactly. So people did the calculations, and that, you know, that is a very sophisticated piece of physics to do the calculations and realise that graphite, this very soft material, has in it, each layer should be a very strong material, mm-hmm. and that's weird.
Yeah.
But people were like, how are we going to get one layer to test this hypothesis? And there were lots of people working on this, but André Geim and his co-workers took the simplest route, which is, okay, I'm going to get a piece of sellotape, I'm going to put it on a lump of graphite, and I'm going to take it off, and I've got now, he had, you know, a black piece of graphite stuck to the sellotape. Now, how many layers is on it? He wondered. Well, however many there are, let's say there's 1,000. Then he put another piece of sellotape on top of that bit and split it again. So now he's got half as many, let's say it's 500, and did it again. Now he's got 250, and did it again. And he reasoned, or the whole team reasoned, that if you keep doing that with a piece of sellotape, you're going to get down to one. You have to. And, well, you don't have to, but they did. That's the important thing. And it really, and this is not even a joke, this is how they created one layer of graphite. And they called it graphene, which is one of the, and then they started to measure its properties. And they found indeed that it is the strongest material around and the best conductor of electricity and has all sorts of other properties which are really bizarre, which we're only just discovering now.
Again, I guess in the same way that we talked about the aerogel in terms of it, you know, in terms of its strength per weight, this one sheet of graphene stuck to a piece of sellotape has, you know, incredibly strong properties, but you could pick it up and screw it up. It's not in itself really strong. So what applications then can that strength be, I guess, scaled up to be used
for? Yeah, I mean, I suppose this is the key thing, which is how do you scale up these things that are so small, so thin in this case, you can't see them, it's totally transparent, and then use it in the human scale. And this is the trick, has always been the trick with materials, that actually a lot of materials are very strong when they're small, but get weaker and weaker as you
spider
get
spider silk and things.
Exactly. Yeah, so yeah. And scaling up is not easy. So, and some things only exist at that scale, and graphene is one of them, right? So if you make it, instead of one layer thick, two layers thick, it changes all its properties, all of them. So when you want to scale it up, let's say you want to use the fact that it's a transparent, hard material that conducts electricity very well. Well, that would be perfect for a touchscreen. And at the moment, you have used a material called indium oxide, which is on your touchscreen of your smartphone or your tablet, whatever. And that is a transparent layer of conductive material. So you can't see it, but it's electrically conducting. Now, that's quite an expensive material. The supplies of it are not so easy to come hold of. People, and the price is rising as these things get more popular. Carbon in the form of graphene could be an answer to replacing it. But it's a very different thing taking a, you know, create graphene with sellotape on a piece of thing and actually depositing it on a smartphone in the right way and then connecting it with electronics. And that piece of work has been done now. Mm-hmm. So there are now smartphones out there with graphene on them. And time will tell, because, you know, it's early days for this technology, whether that's going to turn out to be the way to do it. But it is fantastic to think that your smartphone will have a one-layer thick material on it, doing the touch sensitivity, and to think that that material came from a thought experiment which involved a piece of sellotape and a pencil. And I love that about materials, that you get something so exotic and so marvellous and so invisible that you... No one really thinks about how the touchscreen works, and nor should they really, most of the time, except for a moment like now. You know, this program is the time to think about this stuff. Because the histories of materials and their technical things are worth, because they are who we are. They really do paint a picture of who humans are. They're a reflection of what we want in life, what we desire, what we need. You need shelter, so you build buildings. What do you build them out of? You build them out of concrete and brick. You build them out of slate. You know, you want to be able to see outside. You don't want to live in a dark building. So you have to make glass. You have to make glass windows. You know, these things are about humans, you know, at the end of the day. And graphene is no exception.
Another version of carbon, then, that we're looking at using in the future because of its incredible tensile strength is, you've mentioned it earlier, carbon nanotubes. So what are they?
Yeah, so I was saying that this is a sheet of graphite, this graphene. It's just pure carbon in this hexagonal pattern. Mm-hmm. It's a very strong material. Now imagine rolling up into a tube. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what a carbon nanotube is. So it's still hexagonally has this pattern, but now it's a tube. Well, that tube is very, very stiff, very, very strong. You know, you're familiar with the idea that if you take a piece of paper, it's floppy and easy to mold. But as soon as you make it into a tube, it becomes stiff. Well, now you've done it with graphene and you've made a nanotube. Now, nanotubes have mostly air in them, mostly hollow. So this is great. If you want strength per weight, this is fantastic. And now you have a three-dimensional object. So now it's not just on a surface. Now you can build something like a cable. And cables, well, there are a lot of cables around in our lives that we need to be strong. So buildings, for a long time, have been limited not actually by the construction materials, but by how high you can get a lift to go up. Like lifts, quite a difficult thing. You know, buildings, we're getting up to a kilometre now, where buildings can get up to a kilometre. That seems like a long way. It's a tall building, but it's not. It's nothing. You know, not going to get into space. You're not going to be able to. It's a pinprick on the Earth. But what if we could build? What if we could build our way off the planet? That'd be amazing. How would we do it? Well, you're going to need light, strong materials, and carbon nanotubes are the prime. They're in the frame for it.
Just to finish off on carbon, then, we mentioned diamonds at the beginning, and I said, you know, we might talk about something that is actually turns out to be harder than diamonds. So let's talk about this Lonsdaleite.
Yes.
What is this?
Well, this is another form of carbon, which you can only form when you're in extremely high temperatures and pressures. And the only time people have seen it formed is when you get a meteorite crashing into the Earth, which is made of carbon, and it creates this lonsdaleite. So there's hardly any of it around. I mean, if you could make a ring out of lonsdaleite, I mean, that would be the rarest and most wonderful form of undying, a symbol of undying love that you could get, because it would have to have come from a comet or a meteorite crashing into the Earth. I mean, there are other materials that are now harder than diamond, synthetic ones, and diamond is, you know, been knocked off its perch in terms of the hardest material around, and graphene has come along saying it's the new sexy form of carbon. It'd be interesting to see whether diamond rings themselves lose their appeal as a result of this, because they are a manufactured cultural symbol. They weren't, you know, they were obviously the gemstones of kings and queens for a long time. Most diamonds came from India until they were discovered in South Africa. But they weren't really the sort of things that people had on their fingers. This has been a whole marketing ploy to create the desire that your relationship is not complete unless there's a diamond involved. And many songs, in fact, diamonds are not as rare as the price may seem. But, you know, there is a lot of price controls going on in diamonds to keep them expensive and rare and a desired object. And so here you have a material which is part of our lives. You know, it's part of almost every wedding ceremony you ever go to. It's a form of carbon that's, you know, transparent and glistening and luminescent, but it's not the hardest material anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, lonsdaleite is a girl's best friend, doesn't scan necessarily as well, I guess. We're nearly running out of time, but just one question to finish off then. I'd just like to end the interview talking a little bit about, let's talk about the Institute of Making, and there's a library of materials there. Tell us what that's like.
Yeah, I mean, about 10 years ago, I started collecting materials and with a group of other people who got together and we started building a library of materials. We just figured that, you know, come on, there's libraries of books, DVDs, everything else, and yet materials on which our whole civilization is founded, try and find a materials library. There are very few around. So we started building one, and now we have one that's floor to ceiling, full of materials, thousands of materials. And if you really want to get a flavour of what the world is made of and where it's all come from and what humans have, the reflection of what we've created, then you have to step foot in a materials library, or our materials library, which is at the Institute of Making at UCL.
People can visit it.
Yeah, we have open days. Got one coming up actually at the end of this month. So if you check out the Institute of Making website, you'll find we've got an open day. There's one this month, but we have them very often.
That's brilliant. So I've been talking to Mark Miodovnik, and we've been talking about his new book, Stuff Matters, The Strange Stories of the Marvellous Materials That Shape Our Man-Made World. That's out now from Penguin. So, Mark, thanks for taking the time to come in and talk to me today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I'm Sarah Churchwell. You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms. If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.